Hi, this is Paul, and we are at WCOM, Chapel Hill Carrboro. This is Touchstones, and today we have a really interesting program. You know, I've been complaining occasionally on the show that I'm able to get people who represent more marginal religious persuasions, and one of the points of view that I have to make this show work, since I represent, is that a guest defines what religion is. And, you know, in a civil society like our own, we do have a kind of way of humanizing or privatizing our religious points of view. However, the religions themselves, the great traditions themselves, don't see themselves in such a personalistic or privatistic way. And they might see that as an aspect of what they do, but they probably see themselves as representing a full embrace, or at least a full submission to, or opening to, reality in all of its splendor, mystery, and reality. So to say then that religion is something that you can choose whether you have an aspect or another is particularly a New Age conceit, and based sort of on the probably fallacious notion of you are what you think. And the fact of the matter is that we may be, that what we think may reflect what we are to a degree, but we're probably much more than our opinions, and changing our mind doesn't necessarily change our reality, despite what New Age gurus like to say. Today, I have Jim Heim, who is an adult religious educator for which parish in...
It's St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Chapel Hill.
Which is one of the larger Catholic churches in the Triangle area. And what's nice about this is that we finally have someone here who actually represents, to a degree, and I won't put the full mantle of the Catholic Church on his shoulders, but at least to a degree has knowledgeable of a religion. And wouldn't you say that one of the differences between... an educated view of Catholicism, and that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about opportunities for adult religious reflection, particularly from the Catholic point of view today. But I think this is something that needs to be understood. The religion that we were taught as children is not a religion that necessarily can stand up to the crisis of being an adult in our society. And that historically, or traditionally, religions represent a more embracing understanding of the world than does necessarily our experience of the religions because of the churches. So, Jim, you heard my opening comments. So what's your rebuttal?
So far, not too much of a rebuttal, but we'll see as the program goes on. I would like to begin with a little bit of Latin. Resurrexit, sicut dixit, alleluia, alleluia. That was something that we proclaimed just a few days ago as we were celebrating Easter. He is risen, just as he said. And I think people know what alleluia means. You could translate it as whoopee or cool man or something like that if one needs to translate it.
Uh-huh. So, yes, so we are in a wonderful sacred time. This is, for a Christian... The Easter mystery is probably the greatest mystery of the most sacred time of the calendar.
It certainly is, really, and it's the foundation of our faith in all aspects, really, with looking at the life, death, and especially resurrection of Jesus Christ and his abiding presence with us in many ways. And that's really the center of our belief in our life.
And also that the church itself is the continuing incarnation of Christ in a way.
I would say a continuing incarnation rather than there are many ways we see the presence of Christ in the community, mm-hmm. as you've just mentioned, in the word of the scriptures, in our worship, the sacraments, in private prayer, and especially also in our life of service to the needy and the poor.
Yeah, and this also, one of the things that I like to harp on about is what I call the universal Christ, which is that if you look at even religions that do not profess Christ in any form, Buddhism, various forms of Buddhism, various forms of Hinduism, that in some ways, even without their acknowledging it, there is a recognition, a change, a weather change in the way religions developed after 2,000 years ago, after the time of Jesus. And that's the sort of unknown Jesus, as I think one title said it, you know. This is the one of the things is what I call like the universal Christ.
Well, we focus on the Christ we know, especially through, as I said, the scriptures, the sacraments, and the life in our community.
Yeah.
And with the sense that there's always more to know.
Right.
And that in a certain sense, one can, say, read the four Gospels and other New Testament writings and read the Catechism and, you know, read lots and talk to people and all of that. And then there is always more.
Right.
And in fact, to underline this, I'll borrow a concept or two from Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And I hope I get my Greek in the right direction here. But they, I think the two words are anaphatic and cataphatic theology. And one, the first one is, you know, it's the phusis is the psyche, the mind. And the first thing is you work as hard as you possibly can with your mind to learn, to know, to read the scriptures and use every sort of intellectual resource you have. But then when you've gone so far with that you end up just still facing a mystery of sort of the cloud of unknowing, to quote the title of an English mystical book, where you've done all your everything that you possibly can from a human point of view, but then you're still faced with the infinite mystery of the divine, and then it's sort of you facing silence, really. And you find a similar statement in St. Thomas Aquinas, who was one of the finest ever Catholic theologians, who at the end of his life said everything he's written is so much straw compared to the mystical experience he had of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard some somewhat, shall we say, lazy seminary students say, well, in which case then I don't have to read the Summa Theologica because its own author said it was a bunch of straw.
But that's
a kind of a lazy way out, really, saying that, well, there's this sort of ignorance in front of the divine, and there's also ignorance in front of your textbooks when you haven't opened them yet, so that's no excuse.
I think the thing is that we need to bring our whole selves into this, seeking what our religion is, that bringing any part, we can't bring a part of ourselves. In some ways, then, the way that the churches in American society are instigated, which are, a place you visit once a week. If you're actively engaged in a church or less, is not really, the best, social model by which, religions, become religious in the sense of fully, wrapping us into, what the presence of our religious reality is.
Well, certainly I find, especially speaking as a non-American, that religious faith is seen as something very private, and even with a lot of people gathered on Sunday, it's still something which often is sort of within the four walls. That would be very different to a society where you have one predominant religion, such as, for example, the medieval European countries, or even places like Malta, some areas of Ireland, Italy, Poland, which are still very Catholic, where, for example, the bells ring for the Angelus, the prayer, 6 a.m., noon, and 6 p.m.
Yeah.
And that's something where the entire community will stop and pray for just a few minutes. And that kind of experience, or again, say, in a Muslim society where from the mosque the cry goes out to pray five times a day, the entire society sort of believes and prays together. And that's something which is certainly not so here. That has advantages and also disadvantages, I would say.
Yes. That's the interesting thing about when we bring our wholeness, everything we have, both what we what we think we can grasp, you know, which is, you know, with our hands, but also our whole selves to something, is that when whatever we go with, it does provide advantages of one involvement and possibility of growth and understanding, but it also provides the possibility of us being short-sighted and narrow-minded, and also not being able to see other points of view.
That's true.
And you know, that almost goes without saying. This is so the thing is should just because there are other points of view, does it mean that the way that we try to embrace our wholeness, and our wholeness in some ways means all points of view, excludes the relativism of other points of view. You might use them to season your understanding, but never to be the yeast of your bread.
You know? Well, that's a complex issue, and certainly from the Catholic point of view, we have a tradition with a capital T, which has been handed on over 2,000 years. It's had many different ingredients, historical events for good and ill, which kind of mark the tradition. During that time, the thinkers and scholars of each generation have engaged with the philosophies of the day. You know, going back to the earliest times, where Christianity came out of a rather multifarious Jewish background, with a lot of influence from Greek philosophy and Roman canon law, and you know, going through the centuries again, then you know, thanks to Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas, they got a lot more Greek philosophy from the Muslims in Spain, which became very big, and we've had existentialism, postmodernism, and somebody will invent whatever comes after postmodernism at some point, and you know, we'll grapple with that one too.
Yeah.
And with each of these, it always just presented a challenge, and on the other hand, I think that the Catholic tradition has always risen to it, we know, with some struggles, but you know, came out of the dust smiling still and marching on, hopefully.
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the things. One of the things I was raised Catholic, and basically bolted from the faith about the time of confirmation. I basically refused to be confirmed, and but it was also an interesting time because that was about the time of the beginning of Vatican II, and I knew Vatican II was going on, but it didn't faze me. You know, being in a little church in San Francisco on the other side of the world didn't mean much, and I had a hard time, you know, needing, and there were developmental reasons for my revolt as well as other things, and I recognize that, and we'll probably address them sometime, but the point that I have is that I wanted to make about this is. When I grew and I studied religion, I never stopped. I did study world religions, but I also always came back and continued to study various aspects of Catholicism. And I remember at a certain point when I really delved into St. Thomas Aquinas and thought, and I said, somebody had actually introduced me to Thomas Aquinas. I would have been astounded enough to have walked away from the faith, because you know, it gave me more than enough to think about, more than enough ways to understand a lot of things, and I found it, you know, quite profound and beautiful. And it wasn't that I didn't know of him, but I just didn't get the depth that I needed.
Something that I strive to do with my work is to bring people some of those good resources. Maybe not directly reading Thomas Aquinas, but certainly to look at good quality materials which are appropriate for the audience. And you know, wherever people are, whatever level of education, to both support them and challenge them to stretch a little further. And certainly, I should mention that my... one of my responsibilities is elementary faith development too. So I have people from sort of kindergarten to fifth grade, and then I hand over to my esteemed colleagues, the youth ministry, and I pick them up again as grown-ups. And that, and then sort of 18 to 103 is also my responsibility. And so at every step, I think, as with education of every kind, people need to be addressed where they are and taken on to the next stage with sufficient explanation and a bit of challenge as well.
Yeah, and actually, this let's talk about some of the aspects of adult religious education within your Catholic, within your parish perspective.
Okay.
And I guess that one of the things that really formulates, that forms deeply the Catholic life, the way I've seen it in my relatives who are devout Catholics, is that they live through the liturgy. The liturgy offers them a solace. It offers them a center, a way of living. And by the liturgy, I mean, you know, going to church, the Eucharist, the rite of confession, or what's it? Is it still called confession? Is it called something else?
Well,
now?
The term we tend to use is reconciliation, or confession, or penance. There's several different terms.
Yeah, these various things that really represent, you know, aspects of, you know, ways of managing through life and coping with the difficulties of living. So I guess that one of the ways that you you teach adults is through reflection, educated reflection on the liturgy, on what's happening.
Indeed, and we actually have a word for that, which is a Greek word, which is mystagogia, which literally means reflection on the mysteries. And the mystery also, again, means in particular the sacraments, in its original. So certainly that the best way to be educated is not necessarily to come to a class, but to participate on Sunday. And there's many ways in which the liturgy teaches, and a lot of which are implicit as much as explicit. First of all, just gathering with other people, gathering with the community. And, you know, we believe that we are, you know, the community of Christians is the body of Christ. Christ is present with us just as we gather in faith. So being there with people is good in itself. The environment that we're in is very important. And again, it's a principle of Catholic liturgy that stated very well by St. Ignatius Loyola, finding God in all things. So certainly through all our senses. So in the church, there are beautiful plants and growing things and pictures and carvings and candles and lights and lots of good things for our eyes. This is, of course, what we hear in the scriptures, and also in the exposition of the scriptures in the homily, in the music that we sing. St. Augustine said, whoever sings prays twice, so that we do a lot of good music. And primarily, of course, in the reception of the sacrament, especially the Eucharist. But also one of the most significant ways in which we learn is at the very end of the liturgy every Sunday, we are given a blessing and sent out on our way. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord, and we answer thanks be to God. And so the mission that we engage in the rest of the week is sort of inspired by and celebrated in the liturgy. But the kindness, the goodness, the care for justice and peace is, again, where we find the presence of Christ.
And since you did begin by talking about Easter and this special time, there's a special joy or exhilaration that comes with in the Easter season. How would you describe that?
Well, indeed there is, and I would just say, well, come and see if you joined us on Saturday evening when we celebrated the Easter Vigil, and there's a lot of symbolism in that which really captures what it is. We actually started outside the church, started in darkness. This particular liturgy always begins at night, and we light a fire. And the fire is representative of, you know, light reappearing in darkness, the light of Christ reappearing after the darkness of death. And we take a light from that, carry it in procession. The priest intones, Christ our light, we answer thanks be to God. Then we go back into the church. There's a wonderful prayer called the Exultet, which is exulting and rejoicing in the meaning of the resurrection. We go back to creation in listening to the scriptures. We go all the way through creation, through the history of Israel, how God saved Israel from slavery in Egypt. And that all, you know, this is still in darkness with candles, so it looks all very intimate. Then the lights come on with great drama, and then we launch into the gospel and the story of the resurrection. What follows that then is we celebrate baptism, And baptism, there's one of the readings actually is from St. Paul's letter to the Romans, and he says baptism means that we die with Christ and then we rise to new life with him. And, you know, that's a sort of a verbal explanation, but then when you see it, we have an immersion font at St. Thomas More. We had, I think, about 14 people baptized at the Easter Vigil, 12 of whom were children, in fact, and I was responsible for their mm-hmm. preparation.
And I mean, by children, do you mean not infants?
No, they will be children who are older than 7.
Right.
In other words, they're of an age where we would regard them as being able to have a real faith that is their own.
Right.
Younger than 7, a child can be baptized, of course, at the parents' request, as they promise to raise a child in the faith. But beyond that age, of course, with the parents' consent and support, the children will be of their own initiative, learn for about a year our faith, and to see them grow throughout the year, because they're part of the elementary program I deal with, is quite a joy. And to see them and their families was something very special.
Yeah, this must be a wonderful, deeply bringing together the community in a way.
Well, it does. And one aspect of bringing together the community at St. Thomas More, probably I would say now about a third of our worshipping community are Hispanic. Many, a greater number from Mexico, but also other Latin American countries. And to build unity between the Anglo and Hispanic parts of the parish sometimes takes a little effort. But that, most of the children, in fact, came from Hispanic families. And so to work with them, we have some bilingual teachers who make that happen for us. Was a great joy, and it really did help to show in our own little corner of the world something of the universality of the Catholic faith, that
yeah.
you find Catholics in every nation under the sun.
Yeah. Well, there has been I've been in the Triangle area for the last 12 years, and one of the things, of course, I'm from California,
mm-hmm.
but one of the things I've noticed here is, and as everyone else has noticed, that we've had a wonderful influx of Mexican-American Mexicans who've joined our community. And for me, I'm really happy about it because I get good, you know, Mexican food now. But beyond that reason, I think it's great that the that a lot of the churches have opened up to this this change in demographics that we've had recently
mm-hmm.
in North Carolina.
That could be better than it is, because some of our members have been let down and neglected in other places, and we're happy that we're doing maybe a better job. And there's a resentfulness often to immigrants, which I think is very misplaced in a nation where almost everybody is an immigrant. And the latest arrivals are doing only what our parents or grandparents did.
Our memories are short. This is true.
Yes, we like to climb the ladder and pull it up so that nobody else can climb it.
Yeah.
I'm an immigrant too.
Yeah. Though apparently you spent some time in England.
Well, I spent most of my life there. Yes.
The. Well, actually, then we wanted to bring in the focus of these Catholic social teachings,
mm-hmm.
mainly because in my own experience with Catholicism as an adult and working in social services, I found that most of the Catholic social teachings were profoundly deep, that they provided a serious critique of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
A serious critique of many of the institutions that we have in our society that we sort of take for granted as goods that carry with them a lot of human suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even our economic institutions, there's incredible amount of suffering that goes in with the way that we do wealth in our society.
Mm-hmm.
The part of the way we do wealth is that some people are obscenely that way, and many people are teetering on the brink of annihilation. And that creates a lot of fear. And one should question that this may not be the best way to organize ourselves mm-hmm. around this. But why don't you, I know this has been one of your areas of concern, and that one of the things you do for adults at St. Thomas is you have an adult class for social teachings.
That's right. Well, before talking a little more about that, I should mention it's not something which is separate from everything else, because it really comes into everything that we do with children too, because you can't kind of separate the different pieces of the faith and the teaching. It all has a similar origin. And in the very early beginnings of Christianity, if you read about the life of the first Christians, they shared their goods, they made sure nobody amongst them was poor. It was an era when slavery, of course, was widely practiced. They often bought slaves out of slavery into freedom. But in fact, it's something, the compassion for the poor, which is found in many other religions too. It was very much in the experience of Judaism. They were slaves, and they cried out to God in their distress. God heard their prayer and freed them. That is the Passover experience for the Jewish people, and it's an experience of liberation of the poor. Islam started in a similar way as this is
Muhammad was an orphan and was taken in, and part of the thing about their idea of one of the pillars of Islam is this charity towards the poor.
It is, and indeed, yeah. So it's something where it has, Buddhism is marked by compassion as its primary virtue and so on. So it's something which has a wider base. But within the Catholic tradition, especially, there's certain principles, one of which is solidarity. The term came into prominence with the trade union movement in Poland under communism, but it has a wider sense of we all belong to each other, we all constitute one community, and one can talk about solidarity at the level, say, of a town. You know, in the town of Carborough, in fact, I've seen a lot of solidarity in good community efforts. But look at it also at a national or a global level, where, you know, we do have a concern. There was in the biblical story of Cain and Abel, when Cain killed his brother, and God was asking, "Where's my brother?" And Cain said, "Well, am I my brother's keeper?" And the answer is, "Well, yes, actually, you are." And that is that, you know, one cannot avoid those obligations. And the primary reason is something very theological. It's because we all have one creator in God, and we also have one destiny in God. So there's a bond between us, which is something we cannot deny.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the class you have, or some of the offerings you have for adults.
The particular one concerning Catholic social teaching is called Just Faith, and it's quite a long and intense program, 30 weeks long. We do a lot of reading, probably about 60 pages a week. We probably get through about a dozen books or so over the year. About once a month also, we do what we call a border crossing experience, where we go out of our regular environment into a place, an agency perhaps, which deals with people who are poor, suffering, marginalized. So some examples: this year we went once to a migrant worker camp to meet with them and hear of their struggles. We also went to TROSA, which is an agency in Durham, which a community for people with various substance abuse troubles. That was very inspiring indeed. So we need to see and get involved as well as learn. A lot of the material we look at is biblical, and looking at the teachings in both the Old and New Testament. A lot is from more contemporary Catholic social teaching. A big piece of what we looked at was racism in the USA. We're also looking at the moment at militarism, and how we can easily be sucked into these things because the assumptions of the world we live in tend to be competitive, individualistic, and seeking power to dominate, rather than the vision we have, which is communitarian, which is of service, and also using power to enhance the lives of others rather than to exploit them. That's as briefly as I can put it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's obviously that's definitely the equivalent of a six unit college course, or even a upper division course as far as the number of, the amount of reading you have to.
Oh, the people who are participating will be nodding their heads. Yes, it's
yes,
a lot of work.
Yes, it's a lot of work, and it requires the things. But one of the things it does is there's an outsider image of Catholicism which has. That has the knee jerk version of Catholics are by request or by command of the leadership of Catholicism not pro choice. What is it? They are anti-abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The reality of that is probably much more nuanced.
Well, it is, and the caricature, I think, is that Catholics are against the interest of women, and that is certainly not true. The reason for the opposition to abortion is something very different. It's really about our understanding of human life. You know, we value human life very much. As living human beings, know what that is from the inside. But we have a belief that God created us, and our lives are to be protected from conception to natural death. So the real issue is, when does one have a human being worthy of protection? And our answer would be, as soon as you have conception. You have a genetically separate creature from the mother, and that therefore, from these earliest times, the new life should be protected. And it's something of a dangerous illusion, we think, to take some arbitrary moment so many weeks or months later and say, well, at this point a person deserves protection but not before, or for that matter is not yet a person. So really it's something which is, in a sense, is a philosophical point of view which is shared by many who are not Catholic or not Christian.
And I think that the point being here is that this, in our civil society, this is a contested area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we are actually made better to recognize that we are in an area of contest, and a serious one, obviously, because we're talking about the sacredness of human life, mm-hmm. and we're talking about where and how it should be protected. At the same time, we also have the issue of women's necessary development of being able to, choose how they live their lives,
mm-hmm.
and to make choices about what happens to themselves and their bodies, and also when they're going to experience motherhood. We have the and that's something, again, that's contested in our society. It seems to be that requires that, you know, when you have the ability to make a choice, means you need to also have the ability to make a choice that may or may not be right, that may be wrong, and that is part of the thing that needs to be protected in a way.
Well,
now, where you draw the line for that is where the contest is.
Well, there's two questions there. One of them is about that particular issue, and the other one is about sort of the nature of freedom and the nature of the sort of the right to make certain choices.
Right.
And that is, again, where there would be quite a divergence, I think, between modern society, certainly American society, and the Catholic tradition, where there is a valuing of freedom, but it's sort of freedom to do the right thing rather than freedom to just do whatever you wish.
Because
may serve to one's own interests.
Yeah, and I've met and counseled a number of women who have experienced miscarriages, mm-hmm. and have experienced abortions, and they all, many of them, have told me that they carry around a grief.
Yes,
and this is either mm-hmm. of these things. You know, one is quote natural, and the other one is partially choice. But the very fact that they had this opportunity to choose was also a sort of like a compounded grief in terms of the kind of pain that they felt.
Well, that's certainly true, and I know that is the case, and that in fact within our parish community we do have opportunities for women who may have experienced that kind of grief to meet with others and to talk it through with other women with a similar experience. It's something, of course, which we handle extremely discreetly, because it's the sort of very confidential matters that no one else needs to know about. But that grief is something where one may ask where that grief comes from. And I think it's from an intuition that we're talking about a real human being whose life has been lost.
Yeah, and it's there. You know, there's something special and beautiful even about the unknown lives of the many. And of course, in my more angry days, one of the things I would always say for people who were knee-jerk pro-choice is, I said, if you valued life so much, why don't you do a little bit more about the people that are already here? Because we don't seem to value them very well as soon as they're born.
Well, that's true, and even sometimes there's a similar criticism made against some pro-life Catholics. They believe life begins at conception and ends at birth. But again, in we have what we call a sort of consistent ethic of life, and that would include providing the sort of necessary supports. And if you think of, if a baby is to be born and cared for, what does that baby need? Well, hopefully two parents, not just one, who are caring for it. So that requires responsibility from the fathers too.
Right.
It requires access to health care, which is not the case of many in the USA. So I find it very hard to understand, say, somebody who probably would call themselves conservative, who is on the one hand against abortion, on the other one against universal health care. So
right.
It's contradictory. Likewise, the proper social conditions and the capacity of earning a living wage to be able to support a family.
And also the value of education. We have privatized education, that it's for anyone to do a professional job these days, you need college, and yet college has been privatized. You have to pay for it yourself, or your family pays for it. But one way or the other, we don't provide a lot of support, and our public education has been under an assault for decades now as far as getting proper support. I mean, that teachers have to spend their own money to provide pencils and papers for their students, which is much more common than one would like to think.
Well, all of these things we've been talking about, I think, go back to this sort of individualism, which is very characteristic of American society. And it, again, has its advantages, but a lot of good things are lost. And again, this good old Catholic virtue of solidarity is saying that we all have a mutual responsibility to support the wider community and also to receive from it in times of need. And to some extent that happens with things like, on the one hand, paying income tax and getting some sort of support back. But the emphasis is more upon individual effort and individual success. And if people fail, it's often seen as their own fault. And of course, there is a personal responsibility, but sometimes the mountain is too steep to climb without the necessary supports.
Well, actually, this also does, mentioning income tax, since I just sent mine in yesterday, that does remind me, and I'm thinking that, almost too much of this money is going to support it's the future of it is going to support a war that in the just war theory of war, which is that we were really attacked. We weren't attacked by a nation state. We were attacked by a criminal band, and to react to it as a thing of war has always set me off as a little strange. Oh, and also, of course, the bait and switch thing that we did from Afghanistan to Iraq, and the regime change aspects of this war. Well, actually, now, wasn't it very clearly stated at one point that when we started this war, that didn't the Pope come out at the time and say this is not a just war? I don't know if you remember. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do, and I pay close attention to it. And both the bishops of the USA and the Pope made their statements. And I think, as always, they choose their words very carefully. And so I'm not going to put words in their mouths. But they were certainly very hesitant and went back to the sort of just war principles, and the purpose of that is to try to avoid war as much as one can and find other ways of resolving disputes, and to regard it as a last resort if the nation is truly under threat. And what they tend to do is not to issue particular judgments, but just sort of to remind people what the rules are. And it would be a little bit like if you're teaching somebody mathematics and saying, well, here's the rules. I wouldn't want to tell you what 2 plus 2 makes. You can work that out for yourself if you actually look at the rules. So here's the rules. You know. So similarly, I think one could say that the criterion for just war, of an immediate threat of attack on the USA, were certainly not present, and that there were other things upon which this enterprise didn't pass the test. One could speculate that there were other reasons, not connected at all with justice, going on to attack a country which had indeed no weapons of mass destruction and nothing at all to do with the attacks on the USA.
So basically what you're saying is that there is a... ambiguity may not be the right word, because there's not an ambiguity about the justness of this war. And yet at the same time, I'm quite sure that like most Americans today, we support our troops. You know, in other words, we support the lives of our and care for the lives of our soldiers, and feel in some ways they have suffered terribly for in a way that they probably shouldn't have. At least this is definitely how I feel. And I don't feel that I'm alone in that.
Well, certainly that's true. They have suffered terribly and also caused a great deal of suffering. And just, I think, yesterday we heard, I think it was 4,000 American troops killed and many more injured in horrible ways. With how many Iraqis have been killed and injured, nobody knows. I've seen estimates between 200,000 and 600,000, and that is many magnitudes bigger. And to be regretted even more.
And the other thing is that the psychological pain that is that people carry with them after experiencing this war, this is both in Iraq and American soldiers, will be carried through the generations.
Well, certainly that's been the experience over centuries of warfare, and being. I think probably in the USA experienced most vividly after the Vietnam War. And one reason is that what happens if you take reasonable, normal, well-adjusted young men and women, and then you take away the best of them and then train them to be killers, and then expect them to kill without remorse and then come back home and behave like good citizens again. And that is a serious kind of psychological abuse, which is... taking the best of somebody, turning it into the worst, and expecting them to come back and settle back into a well-adjusted civilian life again. So it's the training for war, what it does to those individuals and what it does to our society too, willing to devote great amount of resources to destruction while at the same time diverting them away from education, health, and such other good things.
Well, what would be the conscientious objection, which is not a big issue this war because of the quote all volunteer unquote army that mm-hmm. we have, but what would be the position of conscientious objection in Catholicism these days?
Well, it's something which is recognized and valued, and in the sort of teaching of the Church on War and Peace, would want to recognize the rights of conscientious objectors. And I think in the USA, the civil law recognizes the rights of conscientious objectors, and it did do, for example, during the war against Vietnam, but only if someone objected to war in principle. In other words, for example, if you were a Quaker or a pacifist, not to say someone who objected to this particular war. And if, for example, someone stood before the draft board and I said, well, I think the USA are unjust aggressors in this case, so I don't want to be part of it, rather than I object to war in general, then they would not be heard. Because, of course, any country that tends to acknowledge conscientious objection would never wish to admit they were in the wrong in terms of prosecuting unjust war. So, but the Catholic tradition is, if you go right back to the very beginning, where in fact the first Christians were complete pacifists, and for example were forbidden to be gladiators, to participate in the Roman army. You may know the story, or you probably, you know, at least heard of St. George, the patron saint of England, and he's often portrayed in soldiers' armor and so on. He was indeed a soldier, and how he became a martyr was he refused to serve any longer in the Roman army. He refused to pick up the sword and kill people. So, in fact, he was executed as a conscientious objector. So,
you mean he didn't slay the dragon?
Yes, he did. He did slay the dragon. But the dragon, of course, was symbolic of the Roman Empire.
Uh-huh.
And in the book of Revelation, there's one which I regard as the science fiction movie of the Bible. There is the dragon with seven horns or something, and it is symbolic of the oppressive power of the Roman Empire. So, in fact, the Roman Empire really was overcome by the faith and courage of the Christian martyrs. So it's a nice symbolic representation, but it's something which, in fact, is, again, it's an expression of that valuing of human life and to refrain from, as much as one can, from damaging or harming or taking human life.
Well, and this actually does raise an interesting issue, because I am sure to some degree that the zeal and idealism of the suicide bombers, mm-hmm. of the Muslim suicide bombers, that to the degree that they are truly submissive to the way they understand their faith, feel the oppression of the dragon of America, as they see it, as stifling their own societies and the governments that they've suffer under. But one of the things that is interesting is, you know, but it's been, you know, deformed in a way, you know, because at least in the traditional view of Islam, killing oneself and killing others indiscriminately is not a real act of jihad. It's not a real act of standing up for their understanding of the faith.
And the tragedy is with a lot of these that if you go to the fundamental teachings of Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and other religions too, they have a great deal more in common. And in many cases, I think what's happened is that all those particular societies are driven and motivated by other things, by a desire for power and dominance, rather than by Christian, Jewish, or Islamic principles. There were times in, for example, medieval Spain when Christians, Jews, and Muslims, the three of them studied at the same universities and taught and lived together quite peaceably. So it's entirely possible, but a lot depends on which you put as your priority, whether it's ambition and dominance or whether it's peace and love and service.
For instance, St. Francis of Assisi went to the Middle East, and actually he was seeking to become a martyr in the sense that he was going to convert the Muslims to Christianity. And Saladin himself actually scooped him up and shipped him back home.
Well, he met Saladin, and yeah, they had a very good conversation there. And
yes,
in fact, to this
yes.
day, the Franciscans have freedom of movement throughout the Muslim lands because of that recognition by Saladin that, you know, he said, I would have no dispute with Christians if they were all like Francis. And Francis was certainly somebody with a great deal of faith. And I think, again, what one sees that there's a different way of approaching these differences. Francis showed it with great simplicity and courage, and his example is a good one for this day.
Yeah, I always one of the things I always like to remind people of is, you know, St. Francis spent about 8 months of the year in solitary prayer, and about four months of the year out preaching frenetically amongst the masses. And so he definitely had long periods of retreat where he regenerated himself.
Well, he did, and he could not have done one without the other, I don't think.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of steer us back around into the dated. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about the parish that you work in and some of the things that take place there for Catholics who may be listening or for people who might be interested in seeing what's going on.
Gosh, there's so much to say. The name is St. Thomas More. We are located in Chapel Hill. The community has probably about 2,200 families now, so that's pretty big. I already described something of our Sunday worship, and it's always very special at Easter, but it's very good the rest of the time with a lot of good music, good preaching, and wonderful people.
How many priests do you have in the parish?
We have one full-time at the moment, John Durbin, and
right.
We have several other priests who help us, and who either are teaching at Duke, for example, or we have a retired priest who helps a bit, and others from other parishes who come by from time to time.
Right.
We could do with a few more, if the bishop's listening.
Yeah.
We could do with at least one who speaks Spanish.
Yeah, the... Now, one of the things that's changed in very much in America, but also in a lot of other places, is that recruiting for the priesthood has diminished amongst those Anglo-American families, mm-hmm. in a way that a lot of new priests in the thing have been from Vietnamese or from immigrant communities, and in our society, and there's been also the growth of lay participation in the parishes specifically because mm-hmm. of this. There's definitely much more room for deacons, for doing assistance at Eucharist, etc., that didn't take place when I was a child.
That's true. That's one of the consequences of the Second Vatican Council, which we discussed earlier, where a recognition that the church is everybody, not just the clergy. And, I mean, at St. Thomas More, I think there's something like 16 full-time and about 7 or 8 part-time people employed, and all lay people, as well as our priest, and all of us very busy in different aspects of the work. In the parish, we have many different ministries. Some are social, educational, spiritual, or of service to the poor. And I think there's probably something like about 140 different ministries, and some of them are fairly small, some of them are quite big. So there's countless different ways for people to get involved and to express their faith.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I remember from a seminary class was there's a change in the shape of worship.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the classic church was the altar was at the head of a cruciform, mm-hmm. of a cruciform church, and that has been more moved to a basilica type where the altar is moved to the center. And I was just curious, since Thomas More is a relatively new church, was it built with the cruciform, or was it built towards with the circular worship?
Well, it's more circular. It's not kind of exactly in the middle of the circle, but over to one side.
Uh-huh.
And I would say the church is about pi radians, if you want to be very mathematical. It's probably somewhat... it's probably about a semicircle, really, with the altar at the center of that. So people are gathered around on three sides. The picture really is... of people gathering around a table, because
right.
Worship is based upon what Jesus and his disciples did at the Last Supper. They were sitting at table, and that's the origin of the Eucharist. And so that we modern churches generally follow this. And this isn't some really a modern innovation. It's going back to the earliest times.
Yeah.
The Second Vatican Council is something where Pope John the 23rd, who called it, was hoping to sort of dust off the church and to... get rid of some of the cobwebs and to essentially to go back to basics in what was the origins of Christian life and Christian worship. And over the centuries, there had been a lot of clutter added, perhaps. And so a lot of our modern ways are, in fact, in lots of ways, ancient ways, especially in our worship. Added to that, I might add just one other thing,
yeah.
which is the use of the vernacular language, because
yeah.
Greek was the vernacular, or later Latin in early times. Then they became the scholarly language, but now we're once again back to the language of the people.
And, what language then is used at the Vatican? Is it Italian and Latin?
It's mostly Italian is the everyday working language, but often
yeah.
Official documents will still be produced in Latin.
Yeah, I do remember getting a second edition of the of the new catechism that was produced a decade or more ago, mm-hmm. and which was, quote, based on the corrected Latin edition.
Yes. Latin is still regarded as the, as it were, the official language, and then things were translated into all the languages of the world from that.
Yeah. But the one of the fascinating things that is happening to Christianity as a whole is that it's under fervent innovation in the what we used to call the third world in the mm-hmm. African and Asian countries now. There are many, many Christians that may well outnumber European and American Christians
or
Catholics,
yes.
And that they are. Reinventing Christianity in some incredible ways. Unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about them right now. Jim, you know, I'm really happy you came by. One of the things this is good is that I'm really trying very hard, people, to have mainstream religious people on this show, as well as people representing the more marginal religions.
In North Carolina, we're still kind of marginal, probably less than 1% still.
Yes, yes.
So not worldwide, we're kind of big, but not locally.
And I have a buddy who just showed up, Rocco, and whose show on Saturday mornings is legendary here. How you doing, Rocco? I got to figure out how to make his bike alive. Okay, there you go.
Got it ready, Paul?
Yeah, I got it, yeah. So, Rocco, how are you doing? And nice to see you.
How are you, Paul?
Good. Rocco is the guy that actually got me started with the Touchstones, and so I want to recognize him as the guy who pushed me in here. He's a principal at one of the local schools in the outlying area, and has been an educator, I guess, all your professional life, huh, Rocco?
Oh, I would say, Paul, about 40 years.
40 years?
Long time.
Yeah, but yeah.
I stopped by to say hello, and I think you have a terrific show. You sound good on the air, and I think you're a real asset.
And we had a great guest here today with Jim Hine, and I hope to have him back again in a few months or whenever, and we will continue in another direction.
May I have one last word? If
yes,
anybody
please.
Would like to, having heard the program, to call me or find out more about the Catholic faith or St. Thomas More Church, you could email me at jhynes@st-thomasmore.org or call me at 919-942-6237.
Thank you, Jim. I'm glad you got that. You got that in there. You've been listening to WCOM in Carrboro, Chapel Hill. This is Touchstones. I'm your host, Paul Nagy. Thank you again. Next week, April Fools, we are going to have men from the men's movement, which I thought was a good April Fools topic, and we'll be talking about is it the last gasp of the patriarchy? Or a resurgence of it. We will find out next week with our guests. So thank you for being here, and so long.